genocide against native people is still going on today, all over the world.
Native Solidarity News. It's about you, too. CKUT, CKDU, CFBEX, CFUV, CHFN, CHLY, CHMA, CHSR, CJLY, CJSF, CJSW, Radio 90.
Of all independence.
There you go. I was wondering why I couldn't hear myself. The mic was off. Yes, I'm a bad techie. All right, this is Native Solidarity News, as I mentioned before. Now, what we have is a great show for you. We've got a feature on that Dan is now preparing. And we've got the news, which we usually let you know near the end, but Dan's going to be coming up with a feature very soon. What we're going to have is we're going to have a little music, and we're going to have a little talk and a little discussion about what's going on in the world. And naturally, this very special anniversary that is today, it is the 16th anniversary of the Polytechnic massacre, which happened in 1989. It's when Marc Lepine murdered 14 women, and he himself at the École Polytechnique in Montreal, blaming his failure at the school on feminists. And it can't be said enough: violence against women from indigenous nations is an epidemic, and it's getting worse. This visit the website sisterinspirit.ca to find out how to get involved in fighting the racist and sexist violence. But right now, what we're going to do is I'm going to bring that up a little bit later. I'm going to announce that a little bit later. What we got is a little cash-in coming up here.
two things happen to a man in jail. He comes out a killer, or he comes out a Christian.
Samson Cree. This week has been a bad week for them. Last week, a 15-year fight ended in disappointment for the Central Alberta First Nation. A federal judge threw out the Samson Cree's claim to $600 million of oil money. It's a pretty devastating loss. In my view, the federal government, when it comes to Indians, can do whatever it wants, said James O'Reilly, lawyer for the Samson Cree. The case was about oil on the reserve. Last year, the court ordered the government to pay back $350 million in royalties taken over 5 decades. The band was looking for interest and damages, saying it was entitled to under a treaty signed in 1867. The Crown said those rights were signed away, and Judge Max Tittlebaum agreed. In his judgment, he said the band's argument may represent a present-day reconstruction of what current generations wished had happened or thought should have happened. Tittlebaum also said the 1867 treaty does not speak to the issue of how Indian monies are to be held and administered. It's very disappointing to see a judge grant that kind of approval to the Crown, said O'Reilly. The case itself dragged on for 15 years. Last year, it said a Canadian first by calling former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien to testify about how he handled the issue when he was Minister of Indian Affairs. History professor Natalie Kermoil says Friday's ruling highlights a vast challenge for other bands with similar claims. It's fairly obvious that First Nations see treaties quite differently than the federal government, she said. The band at this point has not decided whether or not to appeal. But federal lawyers offered the Samson Cree $196 million to settle the lawsuit over the mismanaged energy monies just days before the judge threw out their claim. The offer was rejected by the Samson Cree on December 1st, hours before the federal court justice dismissed the band's claim to $600 million in oil and gas royalties. The federal offer was hand-delivered to Samson Chief Victor Buffalo on November 25th and stipulated that acceptance would settle all outstanding claims and legal actions involving the band. That included cases in Alberta courts involving oil company royalties. The settlement must resolve issues relating to the future handling of Indian monies as well as the past, said a two-page letter signed by Tim Christensen of the Indian and Northern Affairs Canada. Last Friday, Tittlebaum ruled that the federal government did nothing wrong in the way it handled resource revenues, and the Samson Cree were not entitled to any damages. Samson has not established an Aboriginal or treaty right to own, manage, control, or administer their own reserve lands, resources, and any money arising therefrom, Tittlebaum said in the 368-page decision, adding he did not believe there was ever any historical understanding that the bands would handle their own resources. Quite the contrary. It is clear that this was to be a function and responsibility of the Crown, he wrote. In my opinion, the Cree leadership who signed Treaty 6 understood that by doing so, they were putting themselves under the protection of the Crown in return for certain specified benefits. Buffalo said money that the Central Alberta Band will appeal the decision and plans to meet with his lawyers Tuesday. This was a slap in the face, Buffalo said from his office in Hobama, Alberta. It runs counter to everything we thought justice was all about. It doesn't make sense to give us our money, then say the Indian Act was fair and reasonable. This January, Tittlebaum ordered Ottawa to return $360 million to the band and remove itself as a trustee of Samson oil and gas money. Samson Cree lawyer James O'Reilly was stunned by the scope of Tittlebaum's ruling, which ruled against the band in virtually every aspect of the case. Its judgment that sets back the rights of treaty Indians maybe 100 years, O'Reilly said, whose 40 years in Aboriginal litigation includes such high-profile clients as the Mohawks at Oka or Gunasataki. He discounted the testimony of elders, O'Reilly said from his Montreal office. He's followed essentially the word of the white men and has written the word of the white men. It's as if the white men cannot be biased, but Indians might be biased in their recounting of history. Tittlebaum began hearing evidence in March 2000 on allegations that Treaty 6 negotiations in 1867 gave the Cree subsurface mineral rights. Federal lawyers argued that the Samson Cree signed those rights away in 1946 and the funds were not mismanaged. O'Reilly said the legal battle has cost the Samson Cree more than $70 million and estimates that Ottawa's bill is probably similar. The handling of royalties are just one part of the band's $1.4 billion lawsuit over what the Samson Cree claim were five decades of mismanagement of oil and gas revenues. Other aspects of this case, including how oil and gas money was used for programs and distributed to band members, have yet to make it to court. We would point out that the oil and gas issues, treaty entitlement issues, and other issues must still be litigated and involve very substantial claims which greatly exceed our offer, Buffalo said in a letter rejecting Ottawa's settlement. So my second news piece, it's somewhat related. It's about the UN on October 17th, 2005 in Geneva, Switzerland. The United Nations Human Rights Commission heard from Canada and the Lubicon Lake Cree Nation. Canada, using 15 representatives to take turns reading a 77-page report to the committee, made a six-hour presentation that stretched out over 2 days. Lubicon Councillor Alphonse Omanek spoke for his people. He'd been told he'd get 5 or 6 minutes. Eventually, he spoke for less than a minute and then filed a written copy of his planned remarks. Omanayak used strong words when he got his chance to speak. He accused Canadian authorities of lying to the committee and to the Canadian people about the committee's 1990 decision that found Canada to be in violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. He asked the committee to publicly reconfirm its 1990 decision and to press Canada to send negotiators back to the negotiation table with a full mandate to negotiate outstanding Lubicon settlement issues and firm instructions to negotiate in good faith. They did this and more. In 1990, the Human Rights Commission ruled that Canada was in violation of Section 27 of the Covenant when it came to its treatment of the Lubicon Lake Cree Nation. After its most recent, 85th session, concluded in October, the committee quietly added an Article 1 violation. Article 1 is known as the Genocide Article. It deals with the denial of basic subsistence rights. Lubicon advisor Fred Larnison was in Geneva and said the committee members were not impressed with Canada's presentation. My interpretation of what was going on was that the committee members were really annoyed by what was seen as a too slick presentation by Canada, a drawn-out presentation. They knew Canada was trying to eat up all the time so that there wouldn't be any questions, and that annoyed them, he said. The 1990 decision cited only Article 27, which deals with cultural and linguistic rights. Since that gentler approach didn't work, the committee got tougher this time round. The decision carries the 1990 decision farther. They don't make a big deal of it, but they mention Article 1 and Article 27. They didn't do that before, he said. A number of other Aboriginal rights issues were also included in the report. The committee expressed concern that alternatives developed by the government to avoid extinguishment of Indigenous rights may still, in practice, be extinguishing those rights, something seen in international circles as human rights violations. It also urged more action to preserve Indigenous languages and end the violence against Aboriginal women. It recommended Canada should gather accurate statistical data through the country on violence against Aboriginal women, fully address the root causes of this phenomenon, including economic and social marginalization of Aboriginal women, and ensure their effective access to the justice system. The state party should also ensure that prompt and adequate response is provided by the police in such cases through training and regulation. The committee set October 31st, 2010 as the date for Canada's next report under the Covenant. Should be an interesting report after the 2010 Olympics. And my last piece here is I wanted to follow up a little bit on interview people might have heard with Arthur Manuel about the First Minister's meeting a couple weeks ago. Shortly after that interview, the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador, as well as Quebec Native Women, also pulled out of the First Minister's meeting. And I wanted to read some of the reasons why the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador pulled out. On November 23rd, 2005, the regional director of the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador, Ghislaine Picard, said this of the First Minister's meeting being held in Kelowna, BC. Our chiefs are good trappers and can smell a trap when they see one. First Nations of Quebec and Labrador would, by participating in the First Minister's meeting, be consenting, by our presence, to the federal strategy of imposing its pan-Aboriginal, multilateral, and program-based approach as a way to transfer its fiduciary obligations to the provinces. Our chiefs are opposing the pan-Aboriginal approach because it sends Aboriginal people fighting against each other. We oppose the multilateral approach because it is the latest federal trick to escape its federal fiduciary responsibility. We oppose the program and services approach based on questionable indicators because it is not working and will never work. It is the negation of our right to govern ourselves. The AFNQL chiefs are not impressed with the amount of new program funds reported. For example, in housing, the impressive sounding $1 to $2 billion over 5 years would actually result here in Quebec in only 86 to 172 new units being built compared to the 1,341 new units needed per year. This is not closing the gap, Picard said. And the situation is not much better in education or in health. The AFNQL says the whole process put in place by various governments at the First Minister's meeting have only increased their fears about educational outcomes. Under a positive guise of collaboration and partnership with the provinces, the federal government is simply pursuing its agenda to avoid costs associated with the exercise of full jurisdiction over education by First Nations and instead promoting provincial responsibility. The process allows Ottawa and the provinces to decide which types of structures First Nation systems should have and what the relationships with the provincial system should be. This is in stark contrast to the many reports and studies carried out by or with the participation of First Nations that have all indicated that only when First Nations exercise full jurisdiction over their education and when they are resourced in a fair and equitable manner, that they will be able to have outcomes that will meet their vision and that are comparable to mainstream society. Regarding health, of the $700 million federal investment, $160 million will be transferred to the provinces, $40 million will be earmarked for the development of a national pan-Aboriginal initiative, and $100 million will go to the health human resource development within the framework of programs developed by governmental authorities. Within this context, it's reasonable to expect that such investments will barely reach communities. According to available information and based on normal administration costs, only an estimated $7 million a year will be left to Quebec First Nations to improve their population's struggling health conditions. Another critic in the May 2005 First Nations Strategic Bulletin also pointed out that overall, $4 billion was being trimmed from the main agencies having Aboriginal program mandates in order to fund the February 2005 federal budget. So they're taking $4 billion away, now they're giving $4 billion back. Of the $700 million in supposedly new health funding, almost half of that was abstracted from other Aboriginal programming. $88.2 million came directly from non-insured health benefit cuts, including patient transportation money and prescribed drugs. And as of December 2005, none of this $700 million has been released yet. But we'll have more on that in our main feature tonight. Dan did an interview with people from AFN.
Ellen Gabriel, actually.
And AFNQL as
yeah.
well.
And, it's funny. It's just like they say, oh, there's all this new money, and all they've been doing is pretty much moving quarters around.
Doing the paper shuffle.
Yeah, doing the paper shuffle, because that's how they get things. That's how they make things look like it's good. Mm-hmm. Right now, what we're going to do is we're going to have a little musical break, and Dan's going to come back with us for the feature with Ellen Gabriel.
Yeah, I wanna make it alright. sugar, color leaves, way of time. Strip it down, take it to the house, kill it sometime. Make it all right.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, we have that feature for you. So, Dan has it. How you doing, Dan?
Doing all right.
All right, good. So now we're gonna have that. We're gonna have that beautiful feature for you for, with Ellen Gabriel, if I'm not mistaken, right?
And Lloyd Phillips, one of the Chiefs in Ganawage.
Excellent. So let's see. Now we're gonna come up with that. Here it is.